what is the best Christmas present you have ever gotten, and where is it now? So the best present I ever got, it was like grade 7 or 8, it was the year that the first Nintendo came out. And, you know, that was my Red Ryder rifle kind of moment, where, like, all year I'm, like, you know, just asking for this thing and begging my parents, can we get a Nintendo? Can we get a Nintendo? Like, we were a totally technologically deprived family, so it was, like, books and that was it. And so we didn't get a color TV until the day Reagan was shot, which was somewhere in the 80s. We didn't have a VCR by the time I was in grade 7. No computer in the house, all that kind of stuff. So, like we were, you know, my technology salvation was going to be this Nintendo. So we're waiting for it, we're asking for it, and Christmas Day rolls around. We get up early. My brother and I run to out into the living room. We're opening up presents, and there's no Nintendo. And then my grandma shows up for Christmas dinner, and she has her present. Guess what it was? It was Nintendo. So, from that day on, there's probably like a 6-month period where all I did is play Nintendo. And Super Mario Brothers, you know, the original Super Mario Brothers, my goal was to play it from beginning to end without dying and without taking any of the skips. Like, you could skip levels, but I wanted to play it beginning to end. And so it took me probably 6 or 7 months playing it every day. I finally got to where I could go all the way through without dying. And I literally, like, dropped the controller, turned it off, and I mean, I maybe played it a few times after that, but that was it. I had no more interest in video games. And I still don't understand the video game thing, so sorry for those of you that are deeply committed to video games. Anyway, so, you know, that is a picture, though, of Christmas for most of us, isn't it? Or our memories of Christmas as kids. We get so excited and we think somehow, like, our whole sense of meaning and joy and happiness depends on, you know, this thing that we're going to get on Christmas morning, and we get it, and it's amazing, and we can't put it down until about 6 months go by, and then we can't even remember what we got the Christmas before. Now, that moment on Christmas morning when we wake up with expectation and we go running to the tree, and, you know, the picture in pop culture is the kids running down the stairs and the room is aglow with the lights of the Christmas tree and sense of expectation on their faces, and then this big moment of surprise when they open up the present that they've been wanting and longing for and hoping for. And that moment right there is a joyful moment, isn't it? It's a moment of joy, and it's intoxicating. And so what happens is the following year, parents and for our loved ones, we want to capture that moment of joy again, don't we? And so we max out our credit cards and we buy all kinds of things, and we're trying to match this moment of surprise and joy that we see in our loved ones when they open up something they've wanted or longed for, and they are full of gratitude and joy. We long to repeat that experience of joy. You see, joy is always a response to a gift. Joy is a kind of spontaneous response. It's not something we can conjure up. It's not something we can rig or control. Joy itself comes as a gift, and it comes in response to a gift. And you see, here's the whole problem with joy on Christmas morning, is joy is only as good as the gift that's being given is. Joy is only as lasting as the giver who gives the gift. And so a Nintendo was a pretty neat gift, but it couldn't sustain my joy for much longer than 6 or 7 months. Now, children are a more significant gift, and they will sustain our joy longer, but children are like us. And they're born into a corrupt and a decaying world, and they are part of a corrupt and a decaying race. Everything that comes into this world goes out of this world. And so there's a sense in which even connecting our joy to something as deep and as profound and as gift-giving as children, there's a kind of shadow that hangs over it.
See, joy is only as good as the gift that's being given. And the problem with joy is that we can't grab onto it, we can't control it, and we can't rig it. It always comes as a gift, and it's subject to decay and the demise of our world. It's subject to corrosion and erosion. Now, Isaiah chapter 9 begins saying, the light shines, or for those walking in darkness have seen a great light. It's this promise of God giving the gift of light and life to his people, showing them a way and giving them the power to walk in that way. And then the very next thing in verse 3, it says, "For you have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as people rejoice when dividing the plunder." This picture of a massive gift of harvest or plunder and the joy that people have in receiving this gift. When God shines the light into the darkness, when he shows the people the way to walk, there will be a spontaneous outburst of joy. Now, all throughout the book of Isaiah, and we could even say in the stories leading up to the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, joy is the response that Israel has to God's acts of salvation and to God's gifts that he gives his people. Oftentimes, this surprise of God's action and the response of joy comes after a child is born. And a child is born in kind of desperate and dramatic circumstances. Abraham and Sarah are childless, and they go to the land that God shows them, and as they are aging and well beyond the years of childbearing, Sarah gets pregnant and gives birth to a son. And she names him Isaac. Laughter. Because what else can you do in these impossible circumstances but laugh? And so she has a response of joy to this gift that God gives. Hannah, who is in a polygamous marriage, and the other woman has many kids, and she has none. And so she is treated with contempt and scorn because she must be cursed if she can't have children. And so Hannah goes to worship God, and in this low point, this point of desperation, she just calls out to God while worshiping in the temple. And while she's doing that, the priest who's on duty, Eli, sees her, and she's so overly demonstrative that he assumes she's been drinking and she's come into the temple drunk. And so he goes over to her and says, "Do this again, lady," and he gets up in her face. And she responds, says, "No, my lord, I was not drinking. I've been pouring out my heart to God. You see, I'm in a desperate place." And Eli says, "May God hear your prayer and respond to it." A year later, Hannah has a baby. And a year after that, she comes and she dedicates her child, Samuel, to be in the Lord's service. And Samuel becomes one of the greatest prophets in the history of Israel. The prayer that Hannah has after she gives birth to Samuel is legendary in Scripture. And it's the prayer that Mary essentially prays when she finds out that she's going to bear the Christ child. Hannah's response is one of joy. A spontaneous response to this amazing gift of God. Israel, when they get rescued from Egypt, they're camping on the edge of the Red Sea. And they're celebrating what God has done. And then suddenly, they can feel the ground tremble, and they look to the horizon, and they see dust. And they realize that Pharaoh hasn't yet let them go, and that the armies of Pharaoh are beating down on them. Full of the greatest army in the world, chariots and horses and spears, coming against a defenseless people, camping against a barrier that they can't cross. And you know the story. Overnight, the winds pick up, and the sea separates, and Israel crosses through on dry land, and while they get to the other side, Pharaoh comes barreling into the ocean, and then the ocean comes back over them, and Pharaoh's armies are defeated. What does Israel do? They sing spontaneous song of joy, the song of Miriam. They sing and they dance. And so now Isaiah is writing at a time when Israel is again exiled. Israel is again in trouble. Like Hannah was in trouble. Like Sarah was in trouble. Like Israel at the Red Sea was in trouble. They are again in trouble. And they're looking forward to a time when God would intervene and rescue Israel. And they know that they would then have a response of joy to this gift that God gives. But you see, the problem with Isaiah, and the problem that Isaiah is responding to, is that every time God intervenes and gives something to Israel, God is always giving something that is subject to decay. The promise of God lasts forever, but the things that God gives to try to fulfill the promise is subject to decay and to demise, to corrosion and to erosion. Samuel, in the end, dies, and Samuel is not able to do all that the leader of God's people should do. Isaac carries the promise forward, but Isaac dies. And Isaac is a man, an example of faith. But he's not trustworthy in all the places he needs to be trustworthy. Israel is rescued, but Israel falls again and again like we fall again and again. You see, God is a perfect giver, and the gifts of God are good, but every time God gives us gifts in this age subject to decay, our joy is then also subject to decay, to corrosion and to erosion. And so Isaiah is anticipating not just God intervening and giving some kind of a gift that will help address the immediate problem. Isaiah is anticipating and hoping for a moment when God would intervene and create a whole new age, a whole new era, one that is not subject to decay and to demise, one that is not subject to corrosion and erosion. The world is longing to experience everlasting joy in response to God's everlasting gift. Many years later, a child is born to an unwed mother. And anytime a child is born, it seems like choirs of angels are singing. But this particular one, choirs of angels, were literally singing in fields, and shepherds came to this humble stable to pay their respects to this amazing, miraculous birth of this child. And so this birth scene is remarkable. But after this, things become normal. And Mary and Joseph go back to Nazareth. And Jesus grows up in a normal home, in the normal way. He learns the trade of his father. He memorizes all the parts of the scriptures that Jewish boys would memorize. And he lives an ordinary life. But then suddenly, when it seems like he's slipped away into just normalcy, when the choirs of angels just seem like a distant memory for Mary, suddenly Jesus comes back on the scene, and when the time is right and when the time is full, he comes and he says, "Repent and believe, for the kingdom of heaven is near." And he starts gathering disciples to himself. And he doesn't just announce that something is different, that a new age has dawned, that God's kingdom is now present, but he demonstrates it with signs. He has concrete things that he does that show that something new is happening, something totally unexpected, something totally unprecedented is happening. The blind are now seeing. The sick are healed. The sinners are included in community, and all have an immediate, spontaneous response of joy. The very first sign that Jesus does, the very first sign in Jesus' ministry that points to the dawning of a new age, of a new era, not subject to decay, happens at a wedding feast in the book of John, chapter 2. Nobody knows who Jesus is yet. He has a few disciples. He's there with his mother and these disciples. And there's a wedding feast, and that wedding feasts in that day happened for days. They didn't happen for a couple hours. And they were, no matter whether you were rich or poor, they were signs of abundance. You threw everything into this. and you wanted people to have a great time for days on end. It was a celebration of life and a celebration of abundance. Well, they're at this wedding feast, the wine runs out. Wine was a symbol of abundance, a symbol of God's blessing, a symbol of God's gift, and for the wine to run out was deeply troubling. And it would have been embarrassing to the host. But it shouldn't surprise us that the wine ran out. Because everything runs out. Any moment of joy, any moment of abundance, any moment of celebration always comes to an end. That's just what life in this age is like and about. What goes up comes down. We can't live up here all the time. A moment of joy is followed by a crash. A sugar rush is followed by a sugar crash, as we'll remember around Christmas time with our kids too. And so the wine runs out, because that's what it does. And Jesus' mother includes Jesus in the deliberations about what to do. Now Mary, all through the New Testament, is our example of how to respond to Jesus in faith. She's the first one to put her faith in Jesus. For when the angel comes and says, announces that she, God's plans for her to carry the Christ child, she says, "Let it be unto me as you have said." And any of us who have received Jesus into our lives have also prayed like Mary, "Let it be unto me as you have said." And here Mary is also our picture of trusting Jesus in this time and this age of decay. The wine runs out, and she turns to Jesus, and she says, "Jesus, the wine's run out." Jesus says, "Don't bother me with it." And then she turns to the servants, and she says, "Do whatever this man tells you to do." And she walks away. Mary doesn't know what Jesus is going to do, but Mary knows that Jesus' presence in this moment of decay and disappointment is enough. She doesn't need to know what he's going to do. It's enough that he is there. And so Jesus turns to the servants and he says, go fill these stone jars with water. And then draw the water out and take it to the host of the banquet and let him taste it. The servants amazingly follow through and they fill the jars and they take out the water and they go to the host and they give the host the water. And at some moment in that act of faithfulness, the water turns to wine. And not just any wine, but the best wine of the whole celebration. You see, the cynical way to host these parties was that you put the good wine at the outset, and you put the bad wine at the back end, because people won't really be noticing by then. What the host notices is strange. They saved the best wine for the end. Now, for the host, and for many of those present, this was still the age and the era of decay and decline. They just thought the best wine was saved for the end. But for Mary, for the disciples, they knew that Jesus in the room made all the difference. And that the new age, the new era, was there. An age of abundance. An age of God's presence. An age that was not subject to decay. You see, the difference of the gospel and what comes before is that no longer is God just giving us gifts in the midst of an age and an era of decay and decline, but rather God gives us himself. The gift is no longer a thing or a changed circumstance. The gift is a person made present. And it's this person who can make all things new and who is daily making all things new. It's this person who represents the beginning of a new era, a new age, a new time. And it's this person who will not decay, who will not decline, who has already gone to the grave and has been raised again. And it's this person who connects himself to us and says, "Come follow me." You see, we have an age. We live in a time of unending joy. Because the gift is unending. And the It's not joy that will decline or decay, because the gift will neither decline nor decay. Christmas is a time where we recognize and become aware again of God's presence in the present. Sometimes it feels like the wine is running out, and it is. But we, like Mary, can know that Jesus is in the room with us, and that makes all the difference. We don't know what he's going to do to make it known, but we don't need to. The joy comes when we recognize Emmanuel, God, with us, in the here and in the now. Now, full disclosure here. I've had to preach on joy all week. And I've had probably 2, maybe 3 weeks of just kind of mild depression. And it's funny thinking, I've got to preach on joy, and I don't even want to be happy. Now, this is the time for the seasonal stuff, right? It's dark a lot of the time. We're really busy. And one of the things the Spirit has been just saying to me as I've been processing this and sitting in this is so much of my instinct to withdraw comes from the fact that I'm either living in the future or I'm living in the past. I'm wanting to get out of the present. And so I miss the joy of being with my kids in the moment, or being with friends in the moment, or enjoying the work that God has given me in the moment. Because I'm worrying about this, or I'm fretting about that. I think Mary is a picture of the joy of the present. Jesus, I know you're here. The wine has run out. I don't know what you're going to do, but I know it's enough that you're here. Let's be present in the moment, because that's where Jesus is for this season. And I think the joy comes as a response to our recognition of this gift, that Jesus is here with us. Jesus, the wine has run out, but I know that you're here. Do whatever this man tells you to. I'm going to channel my inner Bob Roxborough and end with a hymn. Now, I don't have it memorized, so bear with me. Come thou long-expected Jesus, born to set thy people free. From our fears and sins release us. Let us find our rest in thee. Israel's strength and consolation, hope of all the earth thou art. Dear desire of every nation, joy of every longing.